Welcome to the Oh Wow Science Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by the UAF Adult Education Program at the Unalaska Learning Center. At UAF, we honor and recognize that we are on Indigenous Unangam Dinangin land, where this podcast is being recorded. My name is Tatiana, and my goal is to bring you fun science facts and ideas every Friday at noon and Saturday at 4 p.m. on KUCB. Episode 3, The Secret Life of Trees. In this episode, I want to talk about some of the things that I find amazing about trees. And some things I'm going to discuss today are how trees can talk to each other, the oldest trees in the world, how trees can survive the Alaskan winter, why Unalaska doesn't have trees mostly, and the mountain pine beetle epidemic. So what do we need to know about trees before we get started? So let's start with some of the basics that you might want to know about them. So for example, trees are amazing because they make oxygen, they stabilize our soil, they provide shade, food, and home for animals. And there are basically two types of trees in the world, deciduous and conifers. Deciduous trees have flat leaves, and conifers have needle-like leaves. And mostly you'll find deciduous trees in the east coast of the United States and a lot more conifers on the west coast and on Alaska including. For food, trees need sunlight, water, and CO2. And they, like I said, they expel oxygen that we use to breathe. An amazing thing about trees and the reason they're green is because of a process called photosynthesis. This is an amazing secret process that only plants, algae, and some bacteria can perform. So this is very unique. And in fact, when I was in college about 10 years ago, I was told that photosynthesis is so mysterious that people don't even know how to replicate it yet. So scientists in a lab could not do the thing that trees do every day and have for millions of years. And this is something I never forgot because it was so crazy to hear at the time, you know, 21st century. And it was another indication to me that nature is far more mysterious and complex than people usually made it seem to me or give her credit for. So yes, if we cut down all the trees on the planet, we won't have oxygen because plants make our oxygen. That's kind of scary to think about. So I'm going to give you some facts about trees in this episode, and let's start with fact number one, and that is that trees have community. So imagine a forest, and this forest has a network of roots underground. Where every tree is connected, it can talk to one another through this root system because trees have roots, but they're not isolated and on their own. They're connected. They're always touching the soil and other roots and other plants in that soil. And this is actually a recent discovery, the fact that trees have community. And it really challenges our old perspective that trees are just, you know, kind of silently standing alone by themselves and doing nothing. And in fact, what they do in this network is what anybody would do in a community, including yourself or other people, is they share their resources. So for them, it's nutrients like carbon, nitrogen, and even water. So they share these nutrients with other trees around them who may be struggling, or trees that aren't getting enough sunlight or water. Also, it's been found that trees help baby trees survive by helping them with nutrients, like I said, through this root system. Because being a baby tree or even a teenager tree is very difficult. There's competition with a bunch of other bigger individuals. You're more likely to get eaten by a deer or something else. You're not tall enough to get to that sunlight that you need because you're so small and you're short. And you still got those baby roots that aren't extending maybe far enough and competing with those big trees. So in this community, trees talk to each other through chemicals, right? So another thing that scientists have found recently is that if trees are being attacked by bugs or being eaten, they release these chemicals to tell other plants and trees about what's happening. So it's like an alarm system through chemicals and even the air, through air particles. So these other trees are able to activate their defenses, knowing about, you know, danger alert, red alert, because there's bugs or something awful happening to this other tree. And they're able to be prepared and protect themselves because they can't run away. They're trees. Some trees are actually bad guys in the community, of course. I guess that's normal in communities, even in nature. But some trees, like the black walnut tree, release toxins into the system instead of resources and helping other trees. And they're probably doing this to compete for sunlight and water better. You know, if other trees around them die, there's more for them. So there's always the bad guys. There's also some trees that are called the mother trees because they're way more connected throughout this network. And they help other trees more often. And knowing this about mother trees or elder trees, it's so interesting because this knowledge not only kind of reflects how we think of community, but also can help with conservation efforts and, you know, how we should log if we need to log an area because knowing which trees are these elder mother trees and should be preserved is important for logging because they could help the actual regeneration of future trees and future generations of trees because they are more interconnected and better at helping that forest system. Fact number two, and that is plants have bodyguards. So since trees can't run away, they're stuck in their soil in their little spot, they really need some kind of protection from attackers or animals that want to eat them. And one of the ways they do this is by luring the ants. So the trees actually say to the ants, hey, I made some sugar, and if you hang out on my branches, you can have it. So the ants then provide that bodyguard protection for the trees. And the way they do this is they bite anything that, I don't know if you've ever been bitten by an ant, but ants are ruthless. So they will bite and bite you until you leave. So even if you're the size of an elephant. And I hear actually some of the most vicious ants are found in the tropics. Apparently, it's the worst pain you can feel if you get bitten by one of these tropical ants. I forget exactly which kind. But yeah, ants are pretty tiny but ruthless. And if you're animal trying to eat some leaves, some branches, and a bunch of stinging ants are stinging your nose, is awful. It's just not fun to get bitten while you're trying to have dinner. And studies did show that actually trees with ants on them get their leaves eaten less than trees without ants. Like a lot less. Like to the point that some trees can die if they don't have ant bodyguards. Fact three about trees. Let's talk about how trees can survive in the winter. So this is going to be a little molecular biology lesson. Because we got to talk about cells. So trees have cells that have water inside them, just like we do. So how do they handle standing outside in the winter and not freezing over to death like we would if we just stood outside all day and night? So what happens is when the temperature falls below freezing, so below 32 Fahrenheit, water freezes, right? So we know this, and ice forms. And so trees have water inside of them. So what happens? How do they not freeze? Well, what the tree's cells do is they move their water to the outside of the cell. So if you imagine a bunch of compact cells inside of a tree with water inside them, the cells expel that water to go outside of the cells, but obviously still stay inside the tree. So the tree does not wrinkle, but they expel that water so that the cells don't freeze over. So we have come to this point where the trees are doing all these crazy things with these with their cells in order to stay alive, in order not to freeze. But the thing is, there's a limit to that. There's a limit to what they can do with their cells, and that limit is negative 40 Fahrenheit degrees. And basically, that's like it's very cold, right? But it happens like up in Fairbanks. And what starts to happen after that point of negative 40 degrees is that the inside of trees' cells turn into glass. Yes, this is a process called vitrification, and this is where all movement stops. It's so cold that trees make themselves literally into glass. And we know that when cells aren't moving in a molecular biology perspective, when cells aren't moving, they're basically dead. But in this case, trees turn them into glass. And as the temperature in the spring warms slowly, hopefully slowly, they thaw out their cells step by step. So that is how. That is like a very brief summary of how trees survive the winter. It's really, really amazing. Fact number four about trees. Let's talk about the oldest trees in the world. I think this is one of my first questions I had when I first was, I don't know, as a kid learning about trees. It's always so fascinating because trees can be so old. Like so old. And we're talking thousands of years. So the oldest tree in the world right now is the great northern bristlecone pine, and it's found in the White Mountains of California, actually. And it is about 5,063 years old. And that is older than the pyramids of Egypt, which were built 4,500 years ago. So it's very, very old. And scientists think that the reason this species of trees can survive for so long is that they have adapted, they have evolved several adaptations to do this. And one of them is that they're in this really, really cold and desert-like environment. So in the White Mountains of California, it's very dry. There's not a lot of water, and it's also very cold. So you would think, okay, that's really bad for growing. That sounds like it's a really bad place for trees. But I think that's another reason they have been able to be there is there's not a lot of competition with other trees. So if you see pictures of the great northern bristlecone pine, you can kind of see that it looks kind of dead, and that's actually part of its adaptation. It kind of it keeps only part of itself alive, and other branches of it are kind of almost dead. So it's kind of really funky looking. So maybe Google some pictures of the bristlecone pine, oldest tree in the world. And what about how do we even know it's that old? I mean, How do we know? Well, the way we know is this tree ring. So the way a tree grows is it grows from the center outwards. It builds and builds on its trunk every year. And one way we can do this is, well, I guess you could like cut it in half and see all the tree rings. So you'll see a series of circles growing. Or you can just take a core sample, you just drill on the side of a tree and get to the center of it and pull out the core sample, and you can count the number of lines. And this is actually really interesting, and it's widely used by scientists to ID not just the age of a tree, but the environment in which that tree grew. So the tree ring represents usually a year. So it'll have a growing season. So it grows a bunch in the summer and then it goes to sleep in the fall and doesn't grow. And so the summer will be like a light line, and then the winter will be a dark line. And so it's kind of like the passing years. You can literally see that in the trunk, and you can also see how well they grew. So if they're lines, the rings are really, really narrow, that means they barely grew. And if they're wide, they were growing a bunch. You know, they had lots of food. It was a good year. It was lots of rain and lots of sunshine, maybe. And now, besides the oldest tree in the world, there's actually something a little bit different and mysterious, and it's called Pando. And this is the oldest living organism on Earth, which is a series of trees. It's kind of baffling. So this is a bunch of aspen trees in Utah, and they're called a colony of trees, and they're called Pando because they're famous. And their root system is 80,000 years old. I actually don't know how they know that, because it's not tree rings, but it's probably some other carbon dating methods they've used. And the way they know that this is a colony of trees instead of a bunch of individual trees in a forest is that every aspen in that colony is genetically identical. So think of yourself being genetically duplicated over and over and over. And that's what this colony has done. And this kind of reproduction is not commonly seen in trees. It's mostly commonly seen in things like bacteria, really small, you know, molecular processes. So like bacteria will split itself in half and say, oh, there's two of us now instead of one. But with bigger organisms, it's usually not cloning it themselves. So this is very unusual. And it makes it so that this colony is really, really old, because it's not, you know, one tree at a time or one life at a time. It's a bunch of roots, or a huge system of roots. So why? You know, you might think, why are these trees so weird and doing that? And scientists think that maybe it's a protection against forest fires. So maybe a long time ago, there were a lot of forest fires in this area, and a survival mechanism was to protect the heart of the root system, basically, you know, and to easily replicate itself after these many forest fires would come through the area. And when the fire is over, it just shoots up another tree, and that way, you know, it doesn't struggle like other species. So let's move on to fact number five about trees. And that is, the question is, why doesn't Unalaska have trees? Besides the plantation of Sitka spruce trees that we see scattered around the island, but mostly Unalaska has no native trees. So yeah, we do have the ones planted by the Russians here in the 18th century, the Sitka spruces, who were actually brought here from Southeast Alaska and transported here, but they haven't been really successful. There were only like, I don't know, six or seven of them in the 70s is what I've read. And you also maybe notice that they can be funky looking. If you look at Sitka spruces in Southeast Alaska and then compare them with the ones we have now, they are funky looking. And that is because it's very difficult to grow here as a tree. And that is why there are no trees here. It's very, very harsh climate. It's the tundra. But there are several conditions. Let's talk about the several conditions that determine whether trees can grow in an environment. So first one, we got heat. So the temperature has to be above about 43 Fahrenheit degrees in the summer for a tree to complete its annual cycle. So in places where summer temperature does not get above that 43 Fahrenheit, you're not going to be able to have successful tree growth. Number two, water. Trees need water, remember? So is there water in the soil or is it a desert? So we have lots of water here, so that's not our problem. But another problem with water is it can be frozen. So in the Arctic, it can just be frozen, not accessible, right? Number three, trees need light. So they need both water and sunlight to survive. And we have plenty of light here in the summer. And even though we actually have lots of light in the winter compared to other places in Alaska. So that's not our problem either. But think about the Arctic, where there are completely dark winters. That's a problem. And there are actually no trees up there. And number four, wind. And that's our main problem here because the wind makes it very hard to survive. And especially think about those little baby trees. They cannot make it past their growth spurts without getting taken out by the wind. So we have some big old trees here that are standing, but they've already established their root system and they've shaped their trunks, you know, their whatever funky way they have to look. It's an adaptation. It's a shape, a response to the wind that we have here to withstand the wind as much as they can. But those baby trees, they haven't done this yet. And they require years of growing until they reach adulthood. So if you think of a tree, kind of depends on the tree, but it's kind of like, yeah, you need like 15, 20 years to be an adult. So it makes it very hard for trees to reproduce in on Alaska because, you know, baby trees just cannot make it. So that's why transplanting and planting trees is probably more of a success than naturally trees reproducing here. There's actually an interesting study that came out which figured out a specific wind speed at which all trees break. And this number is 90 miles per hour. So regardless of the type of tree or where it is, it seems that the magic number where the tree's roots just can't keep holding onto the ground anymore. And that's 90 miles per hour. And it is just like decimating to any tree. And yeah, here we get storms that are stronger than 90 miles per hour. So what happens with these 90 mile per hour winds is they're not necessarily like breaking branches or splitting trees in half. What the problem is they're breaking the roots. They're pushing the trees so that the roots are lifting up out of the soil. And, you know, the root is the heart of the tree. And keep in mind, most of the tree's root system is only in about 4 feet of soil going down. So it's not like this image of a reverse tree underground in terms of the root system. The root system is very shallow. It's very spread out. It's not very deep because it's trying to take nutrients from the surface of the soil where most of the nutrients get deposited over time, and you can't go very deep and you just hit rock when you go further down into the earth. So now imagine very strong winds and it's not a deep root system and it's very unlikely that a tree will make it on these islands here with the harsh weather. Number six. And speaking of how trees grow, another thing that's fascinated me with trees is how the same tree species can grow so differently based on the climate that they're living in. So a tree close to the Arctic, where it's very difficult to get nutrients and water that's not frozen, and this tree may only be a few feet tall, but very old in age. Maybe 30 or 40, I guess that's normal adulthood. But imagine a 40-year-old tree that's only a couple feet tall. And so now compare that to a tree in Southeast Alaska where it rains all the time. The trees are huge. So that same exact species of tree will reach a few feet tall very quickly. Like it's still a baby, couple years old, same height as that same tree somewhere very cold. So when I see trees here in Alaska that are tiny, I actually wonder, are those trees really old? I don't know. I don't know until I take a tree sample of the tree ring, the core sample. That's what they're called. Core sample. Yeah, we don't know. I don't know what the rate is for on Alaska tree growth. I don't know. Number 7. To finish the topic on the trees, I actually want to bring in the topic of birds because it's all interconnected. So trees and birds are super interconnected in their ecology. You know, birds eat the bugs that live on the trees. Birds make the nests that in the trees, and they even seek protection in the trees. So birds depend on trees. And some trees even depend on birds to spread their seeds to other areas by like prying their cones open or eating the seeds. And this term is called mutualism, where two species are helping each other like that to survive. And to bring you an example of this is a really famous example. It's with the whitebark pine, a tree, and the Clark's nutcracker, a bird. So the bird needs the seeds of the tree to survive, and the tree needs the bird to eat its seeds and spread the seeds around further than it could, because it's a tree, it can't move. So the bird helps the tree in survival and reproduction and all that stuff. And the bad news is that recently these two species that are very dependent on each other, they're very specific. They live in harsh environments at high elevation areas, so they're specialized to that environment. So they are actually declining. The tree is declining in population, and so is the bird. And the really scary part about these interconnected relationships in nature is that if one declines, the other declines. And as scientists, it's our job and desire, I guess, to learn what other relationships are there in nature that we're missing, that we're not seeing right now. Because if one of them declines, then the other is immediately affected. And this is just a really famous example of how interconnected these two species are. And this brings me to my 8th point on the mountain pine beetle epidemic. Because one of the reasons that the whitebark pine is declining is actually also affecting a bunch of other trees on the West Coast and in the Rocky Mountain area, which if you think about it, that's half the country. And this is due to the mountain pine beetle. This is an insect whose population has been growing out of control since about the year 2000. So what they've been doing is they've been getting inside forest trees and suffocating the trees by the way they use the tree. They burrow into the tree and then they lay their eggs and then they suffocate the tree with that. And so they're actually killing as many as 100,000 trees per day. And like I said, this is only starting around the year 2000, so this is very recent in our history. And scientists are actually calling it the largest forest insect outbreak ever recorded. So Personal story about this. One summer, I worked in northern Colorado in the forest, and I was driving down the highway. And if you drive down the highway, you would just see miles and miles of brown trees ahead of you, which means they're dead. If they're brown, they're dead. They're green, they're alive. If they're yellow and brown, they're dying. It was so sad. And so this is a huge problem happening on the West Coast, all throughout the forest. And a lot of the work that's going on in these areas, like work by the Forest Service and other conservation people, is they're trying to cut down these dead trees so they don't kill people, because these trees are rotting from the inside out, and then they fall, and a lot of them are around recreational areas, trails, people's houses. And the problem is that there's just too many dead trees. It's like racing against time. This beetle is just decimating the whole forest. Another problem about fixing this is that you can't really go around the whole forest spreading pesticide on every single tree on every mountain of the West Coast. So you can't cover that amount of mileage. The bugs are moving too fast. So it's really, really hard to manage these bugs. It's basically been impossible. And scientists think that because of the recently very warm, very dry winters of the areas are part of the reason that these bugs are spreading and causing this bark beetle epidemic. Because usually winters in the mountains are really cold and they kill all these bugs off and they prevent them from reproducing so much. But in recent years, that hasn't been the case. As you can see from this episode about trees and these 8 facts that I brought you today about trees, that everything is interconnected. You've got the trees that depend on sunlight and water availability. You have the birds that depend on the trees for the bugs, their seeds, their survival. And then you have the bugs themselves that depend on the trees. But then getting out of control, they are actually killing their own food/home resources. And finally, I just want to end this episode saying that in nature, everything is always seeking balance. But with extreme changes in the environment, whether it's changes in the weather or people just physically manipulating nature, like you have to build a city, you have to manipulate that nature, nature cannot keep up. And there can be a great imbalance that happens quickly. And this is what we are seeing, like with the bark beetle epidemic. And we're seeing this in different ecosystems and in different parts of the world. These things are happening. Lots of changes are happening. They're happening very quickly. And sometimes nature cannot keep up. Now, this is not for everybody. Some species are thriving. Some are not. And let me just bring you guys, as always, some resources at the end of this episode on the topic of trees so that you can go off and into your life and explore more of what I brought you today. So my first resource is a YouTube channel that I thought was really, really good and also family friendly as well. It's called The SciShow. It's SciShow. So SciShow, and it's a channel on YouTube. It's really smart, but short videos that bring you a bunch of information. They're really helpful, actually, for this episode, for me. And then I have 3 different documentaries about trees that I haven't seen yet, but I'm planning on. So one of them is called The Secret Life of Trees. Another is Intelligent Trees. And the third one is Call of the Forest. So these are documentaries that talk about some of the things I talked about, like the community of trees, how trees talk to each other. And finally, I have a couple of books. I got 2 book recommendations for you on this topic. The first one is The Hidden Life of Trees. This is pretty popular book when it came out, and it's very kind of small. It's like the small book, but it's very beautifully written, and it's all about trees, and it's done by this scientist from Germany, and it's just like a very beautiful book if you want to read about trees. And the second book that I absolutely love, it's one of my favorites, is called Lab Girl, and it's mostly a memoir about this scientist who is also, she's like a botanist, but like a paleobotanist. So she studies the past of plants and trees molecularly or something like that. She's really cool. So she talks about both trees and plants and what she studies, and also about her life in this book, if you like memoirs and science together, like I do. So thank you for listening to today's episode on The Secret Life of Trees. I hope you learned something, or I hope it made you think in some way. And as always, keep your ears open and your minds open. And I'll see you next Friday for another episode of Oh Wow Science. Send me your thoughts or your episode topic ideas by giving me a call at 581-1876 or emailing me at tdolgushina@alaska.edu.